Welcome to Geographical Imaginations. We start our Easter season episode on the steps of the Salzburg Cathedral and at the foot of a curious statue, a statue of a saint that came from Ireland. We want to ask the why of the where tonight. St. Virgil left County Laois, Ireland in 745, intending to visit the Holy Land, but like many of his countrymen, found themselves as peregrini pro Christo, or pilgrims for Christ. They journeyed widely throughout Europe and set up monasteries and acted as missionaries along the way. Virgil stopped first at the court of King Pepin the Short, father of Charlemagne. After 2 years at Crecy, he went to Bavaria at the invitation of Duke Odilo, where he founded the monastery of Kempsey in Bavaria, and within a year or two was made abbot of St. Peter's at Salzburg, where he completed the cathedral project started by his predecessor, Rupert, the patron saint of Salzburg, who himself transformed this city from Juvavum, the ruined Roman city, to Salzburg, the name we know today. Virgil was canonized by Pope Gregory IX in 1233. Known as the geometer for his knowledge of geography, Virgil was convinced of the existence of the antipodes, of people living there on the other side of the world, and that the sun rose on them at different times of the day. Therefore, he believed the earth was round. Ideas like this may have been considered heresy at the time. Saint Boniface reported Virgil to the Pope, and an investigation took place. Virgil defended his views, and nothing came of the complaint. The idea of this, the antipodes, existed earlier in the first century. Ptolemy, astronomer and geographer, talked of Terra Australis, and it also appears as an imaginary continent on European maps. Europeans arrived there late. Indigenous Australians reached the island continent some 50,000 years ago. Virgil's belief in the existence of the antipodes was most likely influenced by the accounts which the Irish voyagers gave of their journeys. And one of the most famous of these is the voyage of St. Brendan. So we want to proceed tonight with an exploration in our expedition here of St. Brendan the Navigator. And we want to look at him in two ways. One, as a person who lived in the 6th century in the west of Ireland, who's known to have traveled by leather boat out into the terra incognita, or the land out there, or out to lands out there, across what was perhaps considered in the medieval mind the afterlife, what was out west of Ireland, what was out west of as far as you can see in the ocean. Now, there's the other Brendan too, which is the one that circulates. The story of Brendan became a medieval bestseller in some ways, an odyssey perhaps for centuries later. And it's this Brendan that makes his way into places as far east as perhaps the Baltic countries, Poland. And we want to, in some ways, ask the question, would Brendan have been known here? So would this story of St. Brendan the Navigator, a part travel narrative, a part spiritual journey that gives both geographical information about the rest of the world, but also gives metaphysical sort of geographical information about the spiritual journey. It was written by monks, for monks, initially in its Latin version, and then becomes quite a bit of a popularized text that I would argue, and I think with our guests tonight, would argue that, yes, indeed, it would have arrived to Salzburg. And so Salzburg and Salzburgers would have had this would have been one of those texts that might have informed their geographical imagination in later centuries, perhaps in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, years and centuries after the actual life of St. Brendan and St. Virgil. So let's go first to Dr. Clara Strebosch, a leading expert in the field of Brendan studies, who will walk us through a little bit the idea of Brendan and get to this idea of could he, not Brendan himself, but could he, the story, have arrived to Salzburg?
St. Brendan has been born in the 5th century in southwestern Ireland. The first texts about him will have been written about the 7th or 8th century, probably also in Ireland. The first were two types of texts, a Vita Brendani, which is an ordinary saint's life of St. Brendan, his birth, his death, his miracles, but also his sea voyages. The second has been a text which was enormously popular in all Western Europe. That's the Navigatio Sancti Brendani Abbatis, the sea voyage of St. Brendan the Abbot. This is a peculiar mixture of sea voyages and the tale about the saint. If Brendan really ever was at sea, we will never know, I'm afraid. But the stories are always about his sea voyages. I have been dealing mainly with a text which came into being in 12th century Rhineland, in Trier probably, which is also called The Voyage of St. Brendan, and which got spread into Germany and the Netherlands in manuscripts and in printed form. That was my starting point. Now, Brendan has been extremely popular, and there have been many, many, many texts over all Western Europe. So my task still is not finished to find these traces of Brendan and exactly to tell where he has been known and read.
So you're mapping out, as a geographer would say, you're mapping out essentially the traces of where this text ended up in some ways. So you're looking. Are you looking at archives? Are you looking at libraries? Or as much as that work been done already? Are you kind of adding on to work that's been done?
That work has been done for a great part by me and by others. I've been trying to compile all this knowledge. In the year 2000 in Dublin, I've published a bibliography of Brendan together with Romanist Glyn Burgess. Mm-hmm. And in that bibliography, we have tried to gather all evidence of Brendan in Western Europe. So the mapping out has been done there, but unfortunately, it was not a real map, and that's what I'm working at now. I'm really making maps now of where Brendan has been known.
Oh, you are? So, all right. Interesting. So maps that would include, if you would share, would include information like where these manuscripts have ended up. What other kind of information might be on
where that? They have been written, where they are kept now.
Yeah.
And it's not only about manuscripts. There are also images and altars and other traces of veneration of Brendan, which I'm trying to get in.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, Brief Expeditions into the Geographies of Everything and Nothing. For more information about the show, check out our website online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. What are the chances in your work, and which sounds like very extensive, deep kind of mapping out the circulation of Brendan, so to speak, and not just in Ireland, obviously, but throughout Western Europe. How far east do you think Brendan might have arrived? And I don't mean the Brendan himself. I mean
We are not talking about Brendan himself at all. We are talking about later texts and images.
Right.
I think he has been known up to the Iron Curtain, so to say, up to the Polish border, up to the border of Hungary. I never found a trace Also in the Baltics, he must have been known, but the traces are lost up till now.
Yeah.
But it must have been pretty far east.
Yeah. So the
Up to Czechia, Poland, etc.
So the Baltics, is that kind of an easy, not an easy explanation, but can we go to looking at seafaring merchants, etc., the sea travel there, that the text might have reached all the way to the Baltics because of that? Is that a possible scenario?
Brendan has been known as a seafarer saint, and there's pretty huge veneration in the Baltics.
Mm-hmm.
We found traces of Brendan in Sweden, in Finland even. And I really hoped I would find somewhere in Tallinn or the like traces of Brendan. I'm sure people have known him there. But everything seems to be to got lost.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are several altars and images of Brendan in the Baltics.
And where are you seeing those? What kind of places do you find? Are we talking about in churches? Are we talking about in museums? Or
no, they are usually nowadays they are in museums, but they have been in churches, and there are several beautiful Danish, Finnish, Swedish churches with murals in which Brendan is depicted. We know that because simply his name is above it. They still are to be seen.
Yeah.
Go to the island of Møn, for example, in Denmark.
Yeah.
Anyway, to be advised, beautiful place. And there you'll see a Brendan on a pillar.
Huh. So how about here in Central Europe in terms of Austria itself? There's some evidence, or not evidence, but there are a couple of manuscripts in a monastic library just west of Vienna. Does this mean for us here, thinking perhaps that Brendan made it to Salzburg, in this, again, I mean the circulation of his story and what that meant, does that kind of prove to us that there was a good chance he would have made it to Salzburg?
Yes, there's pretty a good chance. I'm quite sure he was known in Salzburg, at least in the later medieval times. There have been several manuscripts of the Navigatio, about which I talked earlier, which have been written in the surroundings of Salzburg. There is one beautiful Navigatio manuscript, or kind of Navigatio manuscript with illustrations, which may have served as a schoolbook, which was written in Krumau. That's, of course, not Austria, but very close to the Austrian border.
Uh-huh.
And there have been made Navigatio translations into German, which surely were made in Austria in the 15th century. So, yes, he was known.
So there's a wide variety of I guess we could call them sources. You mentioned maybe a school book. Were there the German tradition of the history Bibles? Is that another way the story would have entered into sort of the popular imagination?
I'm not sure. I never saw that. And in Austria, unfortunately, I never found any altars or murals or the like. Also in Germany, there are many depictions of Brendan, but not as a Bible text. So in that sense, this Krumau manuscript is peculiar.
It's quite peculiar, yeah. You mentioned it's as part of a school text. What's the rest of the text besides
the kind of very, very short Navigatio. There are only sentences. It's like a kind of picture book.
Yeah.
So that's why we think about a school text. It must have been pretty easy for young monks or young scholars to read this book and read some Latin from the Navigatio with it.
So we take this, the evidence that Brendan has made it to different countries far east here in Europe. We understand that he has circulated, the story about St. Brendan has circulated into different territories. We also want to bear in mind the spaces of its reading. And so who is reading it and how, perhaps? But who is reading it is really important for us to think about how this text would have circulated. The who originally in its Latin version would have been monks. We mentioned before this is a text written by monks, perhaps for monks. But then as it gets into the vernacular languages and in the shift in the church in the 13th century, it then has its audience, its public, so to speak, it begins to expand. It's being written in different languages, local languages, so it's accessible and more accessible to a more general public. Although we're still looking at, in terms of any sort of books would probably only been the possession of an elite, an aristocracy, people with money to be able to afford books. This is before the printing press still. And so these are all interesting pieces of how a text circulates. But really, let's go back to how a geographical imagination circulates. It's not just about the actual Brendan text, but I think it's what's in it that's actually quite interesting too, for us to consider these different geographies, both physical and metaphysical. The plausibility of those is quite interesting. And so another piece for us to move into is how Brendan is circulating across these centuries, and perhaps even into different genres, and how we would maybe read Brendan today is kind of an interesting thing to think about. And so we bring onto the show a professor of medieval literature from the University of Northampton, Dr. John Mackley, whose own PhD work was on St. Brendan, and he's written extensively about the saint since then. And one of the things he wants to bring to the conversation is how we're reading it. Is this an actual journey, or is it fantastic fiction? And so let's get John on the phone in the UK.
I think you can read it in both ways. And in 1976, Tim Severin reconstructed a coracle along the specifications that were outlined in the Brendan text, and he then sailed from Ireland up to Iceland, over to Greenland, and then over to Newfoundland. So he proved that the voyage was entirely plausible. Obviously, he had certain things like advanced weather warnings and modern technology, which helped him on his way. But for many of us, reading the text as a literal text rather than a figurative voyage of understanding, it takes away the importance of it as a piece of monastic literature, as a piece of religious understanding. It's a story of overcoming certain troubles within the strangest of environments. You don't suddenly expect to find a deserted citadel in the middle of nowhere. You don't, or in the middle of an island. You don't expect that one of your monks is going to be tempted by the devil and brought about towards near damnation, but ultimately receives the sacrament and his soul is saved. So from a Christian context, the way that it was written, the fact that it was plausibly a realistic voyage wasn't really the point. Although I think the original author did have material that he was drawing on. Geographers like De Quille were writing about traveling to the polar ice cap. He was talking about going to Ultima Thule, the most northern place. Yeah. And the descriptions that you see in De Quille as a geography also translate over to the Navigatio. And likewise, icebergs and volcanoes, although they are curbed in very, very allegorical language, they are geographical phenomenon that you would see potentially on such a voyage.
So there is that evidence that we could kind of look at. What do you think in terms of the reading of it? I mean, is it purely just monastic, or could it be read in today's sort of the lens of today, so to speak? Could it be looked at as being fantasy type fiction. Is that?
Yeah, definitely. A significant part of it is monastic. It was written for an ecclesiastical audience. It's filled with maxims. It's filled with examples of monasticism. But there are versions of the story as have been written in the 20th and 21st century. Things like The Deer's Cry by Patricia Kennelly Morrison and a book called Brendan by Morgan Fruellen. Mm. And these are basically modern fantasy stories. The Deer's Cry is Brendan in space, effectively. So I think you can definitely take the imagery and transfer it into a modern fantasy story, and it would probably, with the right spin on it, it could well be incredibly successful. I remember seeing a children's program not so long back when my son was quite small, and again they had the characters reenacting the Brendan story, bringing it to a 21st century audience.
Right, so it has these elements then. I mean, I suppose for a story to have this staying power over the centuries like this, and for it to be able to make its way across Europe and now us talking about it even right now, the staying power is what? Is it has archetypal kind of, this struggle, this journey. Is it this idea of the pilgrimage, the voyage that... that not only maybe tests faith, but the voyage that ultimately has some sort of reward at the end. Are these themes that and narratives that stay with us because they're part of our DNA, so to speak?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, ultimately, Brendan is a pilgrimage of the soul. And then just thinking about 20th century literature, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis is very much based on The Voyage of Brendan. The idea of crossing the ocean, coming across all these fabulous encounters on the way, and ultimately going to the land where Aslan's father lives, the land across the water. So it is a very, very deeply ingrained idea of finally achieving. All stories, to an extent, are about the search for perfection, the search for the divine.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring together academic and everyday geographical or spatial thinking. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like, how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? How does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. Each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. So I wanted to find out more a little bit about the popularity of this text, and I mean, does it really become then this medieval bestseller that many scholars are wanting to say?
I think it does. I mean, obviously, the number of manuscripts that we have says that. I mean, there are six manuscripts. I think four full manuscripts and two fragments. So it's obviously not as popular as the Latin version was. But I think this is much more based around an aristocratic lay audience, which it's a religious story still, but it's not got the same liturgical necessity as the Navigatio. So I think what we see is that it moves from a devotional piece to an adventure story that has got a monk as its main character.
Right, right. And so it still maintains like these common themes, that common narrative that is so, like what we talked about, what we talked about earlier, that are so timeless in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, very, very much so. It stays very, very close to the Navigatio in terms of the story, but it saves certain bits until later and cuts a few bits out, as well as, when you read sections like the Paradise of Birds in the Navigatio, it's a whole long list of psalms, and all of that is gone.
Right.
It's all the things that would have slowed down the narrative have been taken away, and it becomes a really, really fast-paced adventure story.
I mean, is it the Odyssey of the Middle Ages, like some people say?
I think so.
This text's popularity, no doubt, leads to it entering into the geographical imagination of the 12th, 13th, and 14th century European, and even more so on this popular level, not just now in the monasteries being read, but very much part of children's stories, just much more popular narratives that were being moving around the continent, initially perhaps by missionaries like St. Virgil. St. Virgil, while not a contemporary of Brendan, but not too, was born about 150 years later, there's a good chance that he knew the story of St. Brendan. And if he didn't know Brendan, we have to look back at some of the stories, the Irish Imram stories that talk about sea voyages, very much similar to the story of the Odyssey for the Mediterranean, the Irish, the sort of Celtic, the Celtic stories, pre-Christian Celtic stories that are called the Imram, tell of voyages out to the Atlantic, or what we know as the Atlantic today. The voyage of Maldun would be probably the most important one, which many of the scholars would say is really where that's the tradition then of the Brendan voyage story, is coming from those Irish stories of voyages out to the other world, so to speak. And this is part of that geographical imagination in Ireland, and I think in the western parts of the whole continent too, is what was out there in the Atlantic was the other world. And so these Celtic stories, predating the Brendan story, would have shaped that and really shaped the framework for which then the Brendan story. Now, in some ways, this Celtic Christianity, the mix of the two, and so you have the Celtic part framing then a Christianized narrative. And Brendan, it is said, just like in these other Imram sea voyage stories, goes out and discovers islands. And some of the islands have, there's an island of the birds. There's an island where you find Judas. There's an island that ultimately the goal for St. Brendan is to find the island, the promised land of the saints. And this Brendan's island, this St. Brendan's island, in some ways is a mythical island, and it's, we believe, out somewhere in the North Atlantic. Also, there's evidence that it's out near the Canary Islands, and is named after St. Brendan. And it's first mentioned, I guess, through the Brendan story, through the Navigatio, but then enters into European folklore through this story and through the circulation of the Brendan story. And so this island, it's not just the story that I want to talk about today, but it's this island too, which then shows up on actual cartographic products, maps, and maps in the age of the age of discovery, so to speak, of European navigation and going out not only to colonize then the Americas, but other parts of the world as well. And so the maps being made in this age are getting out of, obviously getting out of this medieval mindset of how the world looked and really getting into more scientific cartography like we know today. But yet, somewhere out in the middle of the Atlantic, on many maps, we still see something called St. Brendan's Island. And so this is the question, I think, how popular or how then real does this become in Europe, this idea that not only did St. Brendan travel out into the Atlantic, but he did really actually arrive on this island. And this island is not, perhaps it's mythical, perhaps it's fiction, but at the same time, it's still entering into what's then becoming a more scientific way of mapping the Earth and seeing not only the continents for their shapes, but seeing things with more truth and ground truthing how the world really looks. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out our website online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. The question always arises, too, when talking about Brendan, especially in the 20th century, was, did he actually make it to America? In the 1976, as we mentioned earlier, Tim Severin and a group of young sailors rebuilt a coracle or curragh according to the specifications actually listed in the Navigatio, using leather, which was available in Ireland at the time, and the same kind of, I believe, oak wood that was available, and built a frame out of oak wood and the hull of the ship out of leather skins, and tried to sail from the west coast of Ireland and leaving from Dingle Peninsula at the foot of Brendan Mountain, and across the bay from not the Dingle Bay, but on the north side, from where Brendan grew up. So it probably would have been historically the place where he might have left. And they sailed and took what they called the stepping stone route that brought them to along the northwestern coast of Ireland, up to the Faroe Islands, to Iceland, to Greenland, and then finally making land in Newfoundland in Canada. And they did this over the course of a few months, trying to do it, avoiding the freeze in the winter, but still running into icebergs, like are mentioned in the Brendan story, volcanoes, which could be Iceland, the island of the sheep could be the Faroe Islands or the Hebrides. And so they looked to prove at least the plausibility of the journey, that there could have been not only was it possible to sail in a leather boat, but also that it was possible to actually make it to America. And so this was a theory, and still is a theory, that perhaps St. Brendan has made it to the United, or had made it to the Americas, weren't even called that then, and Severin proving that they could make it to Canada. This, I think, what's important here, too, is to think about the circulation of the Brendan story and not so much the plausibility. And it's a huge effort to have done what they did, Tim Severin and his team. And there's we're not trying to take anything away from that. But it's the idea that the text here is circulating again and resurfacing in the 1970s. And I think with the publishing of his book, Tim Severin's book, probably gained some popularity, or the Brendan story then gaining some popularity in the United States with its, you know, high number of Irish Americans or recent Irish immigrants, and so it's this story now resurfacing in modern times. And I'd have to ask myself, I think, prior to that, would it have been very difficult to find the Brendan story? I mean, certainly the Odyssey is on the list of classics and fits into high school and university curricula for really reading part of the Western canon. The Brendan, the Voyage of St. Brendan, perhaps isn't part of the Western canon, but it certainly has had an effect, again, on our geographical imagination. And we can look at this at many different levels, not only the plausibility of such a journey, but the existence of islands out there, so much so that they enter into the maps. But let's I guess ask the question: Would Brendan have been known in America? And I'm going to bring on an archivist at Bellarmine University. His name is Dr. Paul Pearson, who has worked with the papers of Thomas Merton, a well-known Trappist monk who from the mid-20th century, who is widely published and has written a number of different books. Some mentionings in some of his books are about Celtic monasticism and the Voyage of St. Brendan. And so I want to ask him a little bit how did Brendan make it to Thomas Merton? And so Thomas Merton is living in the state of Kentucky in the United States. So we invite on the show here Paul Pearson.
It seems to be fairly late in his life, really. Not until into the 1960s. The first reference I came across it when I was doing my own research was in his journal from the mid-60s, A Vow of Conversation, when he first mentions the Voyage of St. Brendan. But then, having access to the archives and doing further research, find that in 1964, he's in the middle of lecturing his novices on a series of lectures on Gregory of Nyssa, and suddenly he breaks off and starts telling them that we're going to do something totally different for the next few weeks, that I want to talk to you about Celtic monasticism. And he just seems to have got very deeply into it for a period of time. And I don't know exactly what triggered his initial interest, but a lot of his materials would have come to him from Boston College in Massachusetts. He'd been working with the library there. He would donate them materials for their archives, and in return he would then borrow things on interlibrary loan.
Right.
So in this period he started borrowing from their Irish Studies collection, and they probably had one of the best collections of that nature here in the States.
He finds in this text this sort of framework, thinking of life as a journey, perhaps, and thinking of and really getting at this idea of the Celtic pilgrimage, to live in exile, to leave one's home, leave the soft comforts of home behind. Does this mirror his own life in some ways?
Exactly. I think he was always very sympathetic to other authors who touched on things that he felt himself. And just from his autobiography onwards, journey, ideas of pilgrimage, exile, were themes that keep cropping up in his journals and in his autobiographical writings. And so, the title for The Seven Story Mountain is Dante's progress through the seven story mountain of purgatory.
Right.
And then the next volume of the journals is The Sign of Jonas. So it's the idea of Jonas and the whale wanting to go in one direction, and then God taking Jonas in completely the opposite direction. And with, Merton's first 27 years before he entered the Abbey of Gethsemane really lacked stability. He was traveling a lot. If you read The Seven Story Mountain, numerous voyages across the Atlantic, travels in Europe, and then suddenly he enters the monastery and begins the interior journey, so to speak. And so you can see the attraction of that idea of life as a journey and the pilgrimage.
And this Celtic idea of pilgrimage is on one hand sort of geographical. It does require moving across space and space as we sort of know it on the map, so to speak. But it also requires this interior journey as well, and moving across more of an intangible space, and one that I think you mentioned in the article here that we're referencing, this weaving together of these two different spatio-temporal realities. I guess this idea of the geographical journey, the physical space that's being traversed, so to speak, and then this metaphysical space too. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that might have informed Merton's thinking?
Yes, you know, I think there's certainly within the thinking in Celtic Christianity, there's kind of three ideas of pilgrimage. You know, just the actual physical pilgrimage, the interior one, and then the ideal is the combination of the two. And I think that was very much, you know, Merton's experience of the rhythm and the monastic way of life. And what he was looking for in monasticism, and I think it was, you know, this is the period just around the time of the Second Vatican Council, and certainly the monastic life as it had been lived at Gethsemane for decades, really, was following a very 19th century French Catholic way of looking at things,
right?
Very penitential way of life, and it wasn't true to the monasticism or the founding vision of the Cistercian fathers. And I think that is much closer in many ways to the thinking of the Celtic monks and Brendan.
Right. I mean, do you think, and so here there's this tension, I guess, in the text itself for us to have to sort out for ourselves in some ways, is this purely just allegory, or is this a real voyage? And I think that's confused historians for centuries. In fact, some people as recent as the 1970s have, and Tim Severin is the famous one of recreating the Brendan journey and actually building a leather boat the way Brendan might have built it and seeing if you can cross the Atlantic. What's the takeaway, I think, for us today in this sort of the 21st century, is the value of the voyage of St. Brendan its allegory and its way of thinking about the inner pilgrimage, or should we continue to kind of allow it to inform our geographical imagination? And I mean that more on that physical geography level.
I think the ideal is to try and keep the balance of the two of those.
Yeah,
and I think that was what so attracted Merton, that trying to bring the exterior and the interior voyage together, or the interior-exterior pilgrimage together, a bit like his balancing of contemplation and action in many ways.
Right.
There's a similar kind of parallel there. And, you know, I think it's trying to move towards, I think, something that he called transfigured reality, the idea of moving and responding to the world out of a transfigured center, thinking of, you know, the transfiguration of Christ, that there is the physical side of it. Yes, they're up on the mountain, but they're also transported into this spiritual dimension at the same time. And that's very much how Merton, I think, was experiencing his own monastic life. There's a funny little phrase that I once heard, that the monk is someone who stands still and goes around in circles.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out our website online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Long ago, there was a most holy abbot named Saint Brendan. He was a native of Ireland and abbot of a famous monastery. Once upon a time, he came across a book in which he found descriptions of great marvels which God had created in heaven, on earth, and at sea. He also read therein that there were three heavens, two paradises, nine purgatories, and many uncultivated lands, and that there was a world beneath us, under the earth. And whenever it was night with us, it was daytime for them. He also read that there were great marvels in the sea, and in particular there were great fishes there that grew so old and so large that great woods and tall trees had sprung up on their backs. He also read that by God's compassion Judas enjoyed some relief from his hellish pain every Saturday. Unable to believe these things, he burned the book in which they were written. As he was standing beside the fire in which the book was burning, an angel came down from heaven and said, "My lord, Brendan, why have you burned the truth? Do you not believe God able to work greater marvels than those you have read about in this book? I therefore order you on behalf of the living God to prepare yourself to put to sea, in order to experience for yourself the marvels you read about, and others as well. You must remain at sea for 5 whole years, sailing from marvel to marvel. This is God's will, in order that you may acknowledge that you have burned the truth." Upon reaching the forested fish, Brendan exclaims, "This one of the fishes I read about in the book I burned. They are so old and so large that forests grow on their skins. I have now discovered the truth about this." On another occasion, the sea began to swell and rage, and it drove the ship forward into a dark fog. At this place, the sea rushes into the abyss of hell. But God pulled the ship back so that they would not be carried of into it. Although they were terrified, their ship was in God's hands. God wanted Saint Brendan to be under his protection so that he experienced all the marvels himself and discovered the truth he had read about in the book. At the end of the voyage, when the book was full, we are told that Saint Brendan, when at sea, had recorded all the marvels in a book. He took the book and carried it into his monastery. All his brethren followed him, and Saint Brendan placed the book on the altar of Our Lady. Thereupon a voice was heard from God, welcoming him kindly and saying to him, "Brendan, if you wish, come to me." Then St. Brendan prepared himself for a sung Mass, which he celebrated with great devotion. When the Mass was ended, St. Brendan died, and his soul went to God. We too, as the reader here, can choose to burn the book or burn this story and not believe what's being told. But what are we not believing? And which geographical imagination do we discard? Do we not want to embrace? I think we have a number of different issues here, a number of different questions to even further explore. But they all come back to this idea: is our geographical imagination a poetic one? Can we picture continents? Can we picture territories? Can we picture islands that might not actually exist on a physical map? Can we build those? Can we co-produce those? I think what the Brendan story here and what each of our contributors and their work, their scholarly work, it forces us to consider, I think, in some ways, our own geographical imagination, our own thoughts, in fact, about geography, is the Brendan story. Should we get caught up on the fact of whether or not it was possible to sail across the Atlantic? Or should we get caught up with the fact of and look for where this St. Brendan's Island is? Perhaps each of us has our own island. Perhaps there are a number of different mystical islands out there. And maybe in order to arrive at them, we have to challenge our own spatio-temporal conceptualizations and the way we access the world, the frameworks in which our world and our schemas about the world are formed and informed. Enjoy the church bells. Have a good day. Thanks for listening. Ciao.